March 10th, 2018. How it works, understanding DNS abuse, room 209 BC, 1:30 p.m.
This is what the presenter was using the first time, right?
Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. Sorry, that was quite a start. Did I just wake you up? Welcome to our second How It Works session for the day. We will have John Crane, who will talk about understanding DNS abuse. John?
Thank you very much. You can all go back to sleep now. So I'm John Crane. I'm ICANN's Chief Security, Stability, and Resiliency Officer. Just a very long title. Basically, we deal with all things related to the security, stability, and resiliency of the identifier systems. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about DNS abuse, or how the DNS is abused. And hopefully our technology will work. So let's start by talking a little bit about what is DNS abuse and DNS misuse. The first thing is that there is no globally accepted definition of this. People hear this terminology and they think it's like something that's clearly defined because it's DNS abuse. And the answer is, well, not really. Different people have different definitions of what DNS abuse is. Some people think that all cybercrime that uses a domain name, which is pretty much all of it, is therefore DNS abuse. Hacking of registration systems could be one, or malicious conduct that uses names. When you look at the DNS, or when we look at the DNS, we tend to look at the data and the infrastructure that provides the resolution services or the name registration services. And we worry about corruption of that data, denial of service against that infrastructure, and some people also worry about the privacy of that data. There's a lot of discussion at the moment in the Internet Engineering Task Force about how we can protect privacy of DNS data. There's also a lot of discussion about privacy of data in the Whois systems, or the systems we use to publish information about registrations, which is not actually the DNS itself. It's a different protocol. We tend to refer to misuse as when people are being deliberately deceptive or conniving and doing unsolicited activities that use the DNS. In simpler terms, DNS abuse pretty much refers to anything that attacks or abuses the DNS infrastructure, or DNS misuse. We tend to use that term in anything that exploits the DNS, the protocol, or the registration of names. Why do people decide to abuse or attack the DNS, well, that's pretty straightforward. You use the DNS for pretty much everything you do online. It's also a, in some ways, a fairly easy target. If you disrupt somebody's domain name resolution, i.e., you can no longer get the IP address from www.business.tld, they have no business. Right? You need the DNS to get to those websites. That's why it's an interesting target to exploit. And you can do various things to confuse and misdirect users. Common attack types include things like phishing, where they may use a domain name that looks very similar to another one. And there's various vectors for actually exploiting the DNS. You can maliciously register a name, i.e. register a name purely for an activity that's abusive. Phishing is often a case of that. You could actually hijack name resolution, and there's various ways you can do that. And, of course, you can always corrupt the data, either on the wire or by attacking those registration services. I'm on the wrong thing here. No, I got it. So all elements of the DNS... hopefully some of you came to the how the DNS works earlier, are subject to attacks. That can be the resolvers themselves, the systems that are asking and answering the questions, the authoritative name servers. It can also be the caching resolvers, and it can also be the client or the stub resolver that's on your machine. And, of course, it can also be the registration systems. So... you know, if you think about the stub on your machine, the resolver on your machine, that can, of course, be affected by malware and things like that. The caching resolvers, not so much these days, but in the past were occasionally hit by what we call cache poisoning attacks, and I'll come to those in more detail in a little bit. And did it move? Yes. So we have this little chart just to give us an idea of where these various parts can be attacked. So if we're looking at the resolvers, obviously if you can't access the machine, it's not going to work. So we hear a lot about denial of service attacks these days, or distributed denial of service attacks. They're very scary sounding. In many ways, they're actually very scary. The latest numbers we were seeing in the news of attacks were in the 1.7 terabyte of data. Who here has a couple of terabytes of data into their network, of bandwidth into their network, apart from you in the back there? I know you do. You're sitting there going, I got it. Not most people don't, right? So that's denial of service or prevention of getting to the system. Or the network, the access to the network, in super large scale, a scale that most businesses can't deal with. Of course, the actual devices themselves are subject to attack. The name servers have hardware which may have bugs. They have software on them, and as we all know, all software has bugs. We may not know about them all yet, but eventually we'll find bugs in them. So the operating system, the name server software, the cache itself, the memory where we remember answers is subject to attack. And then, of course, there's the administration and configuration of those systems. If people are touching them, then obviously people can be led or misled to make mistakes, or they can just make errors that open up problems. So let's have a look at some examples of some of the things that we've seen that we could define as DNS abuse. So I'm going to go through a few different types of attack here. And the first one I'm going to talk about is DDoS, because we just raised that. So DDoS stands for a distributed denial of service attack. And basically what you're trying to do is fill somebody's pipes, their bandwidth, or the resources on the server. And the DNS lends itself really well to this. Because it's what we call UDP transaction, you can actually send packets and pretend to be somebody else. You can say, hi, this is a DNS query. I'd like you to answer, and I am Kaffee. And then if you're the name server, you'll send all those answers to Kaffee. Now, when it's distributed and we have hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of machines sending these queries, that means you can send a lot of responses back to somebody who never asked the question. And of course, it doesn't even have to be a name server. You can send it anywhere. If it's filling the pipes to that network of that service, be that a web server or whatever it is, people can't get to it anymore. And as I said, we saw one of these the other day at 1.7 terabits per second. That's a large attack. And we are seeing an increase in the size of attacks. They're just completely going up all the time. And of course, that means that everybody has to provision for that. So it's a bit of an arms race. One of the ways you can do this is to use something called an open recursor. So we have big open recursors that are run by large and responsible internet service providers, and the most well-known one is probably 8.8.8.8, right, which is operated by Google, and they have lots of things in place to prevent this happening with their servers. But there's also a lot of these open machines that will answer queries for anybody out there on the internet that are even not as well provisioned or secured, or in fact, in many cases, the operator of that doesn't even know they're doing it. And if you discover these, you can send them queries and they will answer back to whoever you decide the target is. Very, very large amounts of data. And so this is that in a graphical representation. So you have the attacker sending DNS queries, multiple machines. If you look at the size of botnets these days, botnets are robotic networks, basically compromised machines with malware, etc., that are controlled from what by one organization or individual, a bad person normally. You know, if you've got, let's just say, 100,000 of these machines sending queries, the people who own those machines don't know this is happening. Sending one or two small DNS queries is not something they're even going to notice. You send them to an open recursor, and they answer with a much larger DNS response. And you know, if it's 100,000 queries, that's 100,000 responses. If it's 1 million queries, that's 1 million responses. And this happens in the wild all the time. Now, not all attacks are of that scale in the terabits. There's also a lot of smaller attacks. Obviously, if you have a smaller network, they don't need to send 1.5 or 1.7 terabits of traffic at you. They can probably take you down with a few gigs. So another way of doing this is with TCP. So if DNS is UDP, which is a sort of fire and forget mechanism, TCP requires you to actually have a handshake between the machine that sends the query and the response. Now, if you lie when you start the TCP session, you send what we call a synchronizing packet or a SYN, you'll get an acknowledgement back. So if you're the victim in this case, you're not seeing necessarily UDP packets or DNS answers coming back to you. You're seeing ACKs or acknowledgements from the server, and that will quickly deplete your resources. And once again, this can be in the tens or hundreds of thousands of packets coming your way. If you're doing this against DNS, you can do this with DNS messages over TCP. Now, people often think that DNS is just UDP, but by protocol, it's not. And there's actually very good reasons for allowing TCP to work. it's sort of the fallback for larger queries. So this is, it's not as common an attack type, but we do see it in the wild. Poisoning a cache can happen in a few ways. Often people think about somebody sitting on your network and trying to get in between a man in the middle of the attack, if you like, on your DNS queries and sending an answer faster than the actual legitimate DNS server. I'm wondering if the graphics are going to work on this. Let me have a look. No, of course not. They never do. So the idea in this case is that I send you a legitimate-looking spam message. Everybody knows I need to lose a little bit of weight, so they send me the loseweightfastnow.com, and that's actually a legitimate registration that the bad guy has made. Just looks like a dieting page. And when I do the query for that, I'm, of course, going to go to their name servers because they own the name. And they can send me the response, and they can actually send me the records for loseweightfastnow.com. But also they can include other records. At the same time, they can answer for, in this case, say, ebay.com. And if I cache that answer, then the next person that asks for ebay.com will get the wrong IP address. So this is another way of doing cache poisoning. You can, of course, poison a host. If you have managed to get malware onto somebody's system, you can actually change where they ask for DNS. You could change the cache on the machine so that there's a little, so that the stub resolver just answers, or you could change where you point them to. Now, there's a well-documented case of this called DNS Changer, which was a piece of malware that would change your default name servers, recursive name servers, to name servers owned and operated by the bad people, the criminals. And then every time you made a DNS query, they decided what answer they would give. So they could very easily point you to different IP addresses, different servers. It was actually quite a nice piece of malware, as malware goes. I guess nice is not the right word. It also had the ability to, if it could get into your router using default passwords. Everybody here probably has a router in their house, even if they don't know it, that has often a name server on there, or it points you to a set of name servers. And what they would do is, if they were compromised, they would attempt to get into that router, because many people don't change their passwords, and then they would change the default name servers on that. So now not only have they compromised your machine, but they've compromised anybody who uses your network. The interesting case with DNS Changer was to actually disable this network. Law enforcement had to figure out how to put clean name servers in the place of the criminal name servers. So when they kicked down the doors to the colos or they served their warrants, they actually had to go in and put their own infrastructure in. And they relied on people from the industry to actually build those servers for them and take them in so that the people who were infected could once again get proper name resolution. It's not really proper name resolution because they're still going somewhere they shouldn't, but at least they're getting honest answers. So once again, these are abuses of the DNS and the way the DNS works that happened in the wild. And then, of course, there is an entire system of registration of names. When you buy a name, you go and register that with a registrar, it goes to a registry. And there's a few ways of exploiting that. Name registrations are fairly easy targets. There's a lot of automation going on, and in many cases, the correspondence, the discussion between the registrant, the person buying the name, and therefore afterwards managing the name, and the registrars, is all via email. Right? So, who here has ever had an email compromised? Right, so if that's your email that's associated with your domain name, your domain name is now at risk. So I went too far for that. So, you know, if you think about the various compromises that are being announced of email systems or even of financial logins or I think Equifax was a big one. In a lot of these cases, they have email addresses and passwords. If you're using the same email and password for your name registration, you're at risk. Some of the registrars have two-factor authentication. They have more advanced systems, but not all of them do. Of course, if you're a bad guy, you don't necessarily have to steal a name, right? You can also just go out and register a name. Names are pretty cheap. Sometimes you'll want particular strings. If you're going to do a phishing scam, phishing is where you try and get somebody to click on a link and go somewhere, you might want a name that looks like a legitimate site, maybe something very similar to a bank name or to a e-commerce site. You may want to have a solid landing place for your ransomware payment page, right? Something that you control yourself rather than something that you've compromised. Malware often have distribution sites that you want to be more solid than a compromised machine. So sometimes they register names for this. Pharma sites, piracy sites. Sometimes you want a recognizable name that is consistent and stays up. So they'll register names for that. In much the same way as criminals also buy name servers and web servers and all the other resources, and sometimes even rent out entire racks in co-location facilities to run infrastructure. They don't always compromise things. Sometimes they go out and actually buy infrastructure. Typically, when you look at the large malware and botnet infrastructures, it's a mixture. You know, the botnet itself may well be compromised machines, but some of the controlling infrastructure may be purchased and what looks like legitimate purchases with legitimate names that they've registered. So, you know, why would they do that? It just gives you more control of the name. When you have your own name servers, like I said, phishing, you want these strings. But, you know, I can also just crack into the systems, right? So if I want to deface a corporate website, I can do that by attacking the actual web server itself. Obviously, if I can compromise a web server, I can get in and change the data. Often this happens when you have data systems that are not up to date. There's a lot of platforms out there that allow people to build websites easily, and as long as you keep the software up to date, they're not too bad, but if people forget to update software. But if you can't get into it that way, what we've seen happen is that the perpetrators will attack the registry systems or the registrar systems and get at the name, and then they change the name servers. And if they can get into the DNS, they can change the IP address for that web server. So instead of going to the legitimate business server, you go to some other server and you get a page that says, hey, we have hacked large corporation X. But in fact, they've not. They've not even touched large corporation X's infrastructure. They've managed to get into their name account or into the registrar or the registry itself. So they've attacked the infrastructure to take charge of a particular name. And not common, but we do see that. So I talked about email and compromised emails. It's getting more and more common as we've had big attacks. So, you know, who was affected by either the Yahoo or the Equifax breach? Not as many as, oh, so most of you don't know you were affected, okay. there were millions of people affected by those breaches. So I only saw half a dozen hands here, and that really surprises me, because some of these services are used around the world and a lot of people have accounts with them. As I said, if you were using those for your domain name registration, you might want to go and change those. This is an interesting use of the DNS. It's something we call fast flux. Now, like many of the things that people often call abuse, there's legitimate reasons for doing this as well. If you think of some of the content distribution networks, they change their IPs very quickly, because depending on where you're coming from, to point you to a specific server. Now, bad guys do this too. And one of the reasons they do this is to make it harder to track them. So what they do is they have very short time to live on their DNS information, and they will constantly change the IP address of the server where their malicious content is. So the name may say this will stay the same, but the IP address will constantly be changing. And that makes it really hard for people to mitigate this. Now, sometimes they change both the name and the address. We call that double fast flux. This infuriates people that are trying to track this stuff down. And, you know, I've heard people say, well, we should not allow that. But there are legitimate reasons for using this technology. And if it's a good technology that people in industry use, you can guarantee the bad guys will figure out how they can use it themselves as well. This isn't something we hear as much about these days. It was a very hot topic a couple of years ago, but it still occurs. And I still get the occasional complaint from law enforcement that don't understand that people can change their IP addresses and their names, which is sort of the whole purpose of DNS, is to obfuscate the IP address so that you can change it. Now, because DNS is everywhere and everybody uses it for everything, it's also often not filtered. Right, so if you have a firewall, there's a very good chance that port 53, which is the domain name system port, is not looked at. Now, some firewalls will block them on TCP, but won't necessarily block them on UDP. Oh, thank you. So the other thing with the DNS is we have things called text records, which you can query for, and you can put anything that's text in there. So you can put any kind of data. So you can actually take data out of a network and bring it back to the bad guy. Now, lots of proof of concepts, but we actually saw this used in the wild about 3 weeks ago, where the perpetrators were doing point of sales devices, so credit card readers in stores, and the way they were moving the credit card details was as records in the DNS, because those point of sale services actually use DNS, and there's legitimate traffic, and they were hiding the exfiltration in the DNS packets. So we've actually seen this recently in the wild. Oops, and now my thing has stopped. Yeah, can you change it?
Sure.
I don't know what they did, but it killed this.
Are you taking in comments?
I can do. Comments or questions if you have them.
Okay, not yet.
Okay, so the other thing that the DNS is used for in a very similar fashion is for command and control for that malware, for the botnets. Because the firewalls allow inbound responses via the DNS, you can send commands to your controlled machines. And this is fairly common on modern malware, is that they use the DNS. They tend to do two things. They tend to do peer-to-peer command and control, but they tend also in the background to have a DNS channel to be able to send signals to the compromised machines to, for example, start a DDoS attack, you know, send those DNS queries that we saw in the distributed denial of service attack. Plenty of examples in the wild, Feederbot, Morto, but there's dozens and dozens of these systems out there. One of the other things that's not in the slides that they will do is the way they control those systems, or the rendezvous point, if you like, of the way that they get the DNS queries to start, is they will use something called a domain generation algorithm. That's a piece of the code which, based on a timestamp and the algorithm, will generate a random-looking name. Now, they're not random, because every machine is generating the same list of names, and then they call home. They use the DNS to try and call home to that machine. And if the bad guys register those names and point it to an IP address, the malware will try and do a DNS query to get to its command and control server and do what DNS is supposed to do, right? It will give them the IP address and they'll be able to connect. That's interesting because often they will generate hundreds or thousands of names that they could possibly use in a single day, but they only need to register one for it to work. So most of this malware variants will start with the first name on the list and they will work their way through. I think Conficker C was doing about 50,000 names per day. And if you're trying to block this activity, if you're on the good guy side and you're saying, well, I want to block this, you actually have to prevent them from registering all 50,000 of those names. So has anybody here heard of Operation Avalanche or Andromeda? So these were law enforcement activities to disrupt botnets. And, you know, these botnets aren't only used for DDoS, they're used for all kinds of malicious activity. So if you go and read up on those, you'll see things like they blocked 800,000 names. Right? People often get that confused with what they did is they took away 800,000 name registrations. That's not the case. The majority of these names have not been registered by anybody yet, because they are random looking 8 or 12 character length strings that make no sense. So what they're doing is they're blocking the registration of the names, not taking the registration of the names. And it was about 800,000, I believe, in Avalanche. So quite a bit of work. And law enforcement are constantly working to try and take down these botnets and these malware families. And as they have DGAAs in them that may talk to or may have lists of names that span many top-level domains, many jurisdictions, it makes it quite complex for law enforcement to actually take action against these. Once again, Avalanche, I can't remember how many MLATs they sent out. Mutual legal assistance treaties is something that law enforcement used to basically translate a court order from their jurisdiction to another jurisdiction and get somebody in a different jurisdiction to take action. But it was dozens and dozens and dozens of these legal documents that they had to do around the world to have people take action against this. It's a bit of a losing battle, but you know, they are using the DNS and the way the DNS is supposed to work to their advantage. So they're abusing the system in many ways, not just through DDoS, but also for the way they register and use names. How are we on time? Yeah. Okay, long comment coming in.
We have a comment from Jay Podial. From India, former ICANN 60 fellow. I am an ICANN fellow and member of Neo Brahmi Generation Panel under IDN programs. I want to intervene by saying DNS misuse or abuse, which caused many frauds like phishing, malware, distribution, spamming, HTTP attacks, etc. In my opinion, we can make a policy where it will be mandatory to give photo IDs, any national identification, driver's license, passport, etc., to change or set DNS entry and details of IDs should match with Whois profile of the said domain name. If you argue this will require human resource to handle it, then my point is, in the era of blockchain technology and artificial intelligence, we don't need any humans to verify things, and software bot will do. As all of you are aware, the moment advertisement platform like Facebook and Google detects any kind of fraudulent activity, they ask for the photo ID of the user and disables their account temporarily. Then why can't we do it at ICANN, since ICANN is managing DNS records of the internet and DNS abuse misuse is affecting the user of the internet?
Okay, thank you for that intervention, Jay. So there's a few misconceptions in there. ICANN is for the DNS, for the most part, a policy development organization. We don't actually manage much of the DNS. We do implement the root, which is the top level of the DNS. And for those who've been if you've not been to the DNS primer, the 101, it will be on again.
On Monday. At 5 p.m.
So do come to that. So because we manage the root of the system, the ICANN community sets policy for the root of the system. So we can set some policy towards the contracted parties, which are, for example, the GTLDs. And that's an ICANN community thing. So we could discuss, and we do discuss in the community, if you're following it, many of these issues around abuse and how we handle it. Now, the DNS is a hierarchical system, and you delegate to the next level down, just like ICANN delegates the roots. And then you also delegate responsibility. You could probably argue that there could be some policy elements between registries and their registrants, and there are. Some of these are policies, some of them are acceptable use policies. But then you go a level below that. I mean, how do you then start policing that and the level below? So it's not as straightforward as ICANN can stand up and set a policy. We, as an organization, we don't have that power. And due to the distributed nature of the system, the way it's designed, it wouldn't be that straightforward. I think, Michaela, you want to intervene as well. So before I go further, I'll actually let you talk to this because you operate a registrar and have operational knowledge of this.
Thanks. Michaela Nealon, for the record. CEO and founder of Black Knight, the largest hosting provider and registrar in Ireland, chair of the Internet Infrastructure Coalition and a bunch of other things. While I'm always interested to hear ideas around how we can better mitigate DNS abuse, what that person is suggesting is completely unworkable for a multitude of reasons. If you would like to have domain names cost, say, $500 or euro per year, I will happily implement a system where I will take a blood sample for every DNS change. But unless and until people are willing to pay that kind of money, that's just not going to work. Secondly, I will use the buzzword du jour, GDPR. If you expect registrars and hosting providers to start collecting huge amounts of personal information which are not related to the service that's being provided, in other words, changing a DNS record, that's going to render the entire thing unusable. Now, if you want to go down this route, and I really would recommend that you don't, then go off and get some national legislation and do it within your own country, but bear in mind the internet is global and most of us operate cross borders and we are not going to implement this. And I feel fairly confident in saying that most of my fellow registrars would find this unworkable. Now, Having said that, there are certain registrars who operate in a totally different way, who are targeting a specific market. So if you are a Fortune 100 or a Fortune 500, you are probably using their services, and all of the DNS changes and other things that they would provide to you would be validated. But the issue that I believe this panel is talking about is related to general DNS abuse, which is a completely different kettle of fish. Thanks.
Thank you, Michaela. Well, you actually covered a few of the topics I was going to cover. For example, the use...
I was trying to save you time, John.
Thank you. For example, the issues around the who is data and privacy and all these kind of issues. It's an interesting intervention, and Jay, if you become a fellow for a future ICANN meeting, I will happily have conversations about this. Do we have anything else there?
Not yet.
Okay, so I will move on to the next slide.
This session is fun,
according to
you. You got a comment that this session is fun.
Well, we're not supposed to have fun, so we will stop that. That's very bad of me. I'm sorry. So let's talk a little bit about how the landscape is evolving. And, of course, just like anything on the internet, stuff always evolves. So I'm not sure if better is the good term, but certainly more efficient botnets. I work closely with law enforcement in my role at ICANN as a subject matter expert on issues like this, so I'm seeing some of this firsthand. The size and the complexity of malware and botnets is increasing. People get smarter all the time, including the bad guys. We are definitely seeing a lot more what we call DDoS as a service. So you don't actually have to own, if you like the word, a malware variant. You can go buy a malware variant or a piece of their botnet. They have amazing graphical web interfaces where you can go and purchase the poison of your choice or the botnet of your choice, the malware of your choice, and the number of machines you want, and pick a target and somebody will do it for you. And it's not expensive. I recommend that nobody does this. That is probably criminal activity, and I will hunt you down. And I will send my law enforcement friends to you. But these things are sold as commodities these days. It is not, you do not need to know anything about the internet apart from how to get to a website and probably onto some of the dark web stuff, which isn't hard, to go and purchase these things. And that's normally the kind of stuff that law enforcement goes after, this commercialization of abuse. You know, we're still seeing plenty of fast flurks and double flurks. It's back again. It comes and it goes. Spam is just getting worse. Now they're hosting a lot of their infrastructure in the term is cloud. It's a salesman's term, I think, for distributed computing. But you can go buy spam services just like you can buy DDoS services. And, you know, an example is the Avalanche malware infrastructure, which actually Avalanche was the project name. It was multiple variants of malware were involved, and they were buying and selling various services. And it's everything from DDoS to moving money around to selling illicit goods, and it's all using this DNS infrastructure that the criminals have built up. We call it the Internet of Threats, or the Internet of Vulnerable Things. We are seeing a proliferation of cheap, devices going to people's homes. I like playing with these. I have many, many threats inside my own home network. If you have heard of something called the Mirai botnet, which attacks some DNS infrastructure, it's probably, I'd like to say it was a year ago, but it was probably much longer. Time gets shorter as you get older. That was using various devices on the internet that weren't quite secured how they maybe should have been. I actually own one of the variants of video server that was used for this and had disconnected it from my network and reported problems in as far as I could back to the manufacturers about a year and a half before Mirai. You actually couldn't update these systems. It was literally impossible as a user, and I like to think I know a little bit about networks and how to update systems, to actually put better code, more secure code on these devices. And if you did get it on, you had a power outage and it rebooted, it came back to what it was. And we're seeing more and more devices going out there, and these devices are cheap. And cheap and security generally don't go together. That's just the reality of life. And people want cheap devices. Given the option of a $10 light bulb and a $100 light bulb that you can both control and make flash and do funky things from your telephone, most people will take the $10 one. They're not going to sit there and say, well, does this one have better security implementation? That's not how humans work. So we're seeing more and more of these devices. I predict that that's not going to get better anytime soon. But awareness of this issue is getting higher. Obviously, people are going to the manufacturers and saying, you shouldn't have done that. But we will see more and more. I mean, it's this year it's light bulbs, it's toasters, it's coffee machines, sensor networks, very popular at the moment, alarm systems online for your home. Although why you would put your alarm system online, I don't know, but people are. So the Internet of Threats, or the Internet of Things, is not promising, especially for the botnet environment, where you think, you know, there are millions of these devices, maybe billions of these devices in a few years. An interesting thing we saw in that some of the ways the code writers use the DNS is really interesting. We actually saw what some people refer to as an ignition key or a kill switch, where they had a particular name that it tried to query and expected not to get an answer. And if it got an answer, it would turn itself off. And we believe that they'd done this to prevent people working in labs and figuring out what was going on with the code. Somebody actually, a researcher, discovered this, registered the name, and turned off the malware variant, which was pretty cool to see that they'd built in a flaw using the DNS. I guess they hadn't really thought it through. That was WannaCry, by the way. Has everybody heard of WannaCry and WannaCrypt? It kind of got in the news. So volumetric or DDoS attacks continue to increase. As I said, 1.7 terabytes, bits, can't remember which it was now, but a lot. That was this month. Next year, it may be double that. These are levels of data that most systems cannot deal with. We're talking terabits, not megabits or gigabits. It's interesting. And as I said, attack kits are very easy to obtain. These are just a few. There are many, many out there. You know, one of the things that people think about when they think about phishing and abuse types of that is their bank accounts and people impersonating their bank's website. You can buy a kit with websites of the most common banks. You don't have to go and impersonate their bank anymore. You just go out and you buy the kit. It's like do-it-yourself phishing kits are out there. Pretty much all of this malicious behavior has become commoditized and become a business. It's rather depressing, really, when you think about it. You may see the term a booter or a stressor. These are businesses that will stress test somebody's network for you. Stress test is nice terminology for a DDoS attack. So, you know, there is argument that there is a legitimate service of testing your network by stress testing it. Well, they'll happily stress test you, and if you pay them enough, they'll stop stress testing you. It's extortion and fraud, and there are people that sell these services. It's quite stunning. So, more on the Avalanche stuff. So, the bad guys had a lot of their own infrastructure. Originally, it was sort of a malware for botnets, but then it actually became a botnet to deliver malware. So, once you've compromised a machine, they would actually deliver specific types of malware to specific machines on request from clients. Not pretty. They had what we call bulletproof hosting. There are folks in the ecosystem, they're not people you would ever see here, that will actually sell hosting. The criminals will build their own colos and they will actually sell hosting on that for other people, other miscreants, and say, hey, we'll guarantee this stuff stays up. A lot of financial fraud attacks. Obviously, it's all about the money. Just like phishing, it's often about the money. You know, one of the things we say is it was like a cloud experience. You could just log in and buy the bits you want and have machines where you wanted them. It's quite fascinating to watch how this has all evolved over the years. And here's the 20 families you could choose. As I said, Avalanche wasn't a piece of malware anymore. It was many different malwares, and you could literally go in and you'd have a drop-down menu. So it's just like buying anything else online. You go in, you have a drop-down menu, and you choose which malware variants you want and how many infected hosts you want. I'm almost speechless on it. The other thing about dealing with some of the abuse is the time frame involved. So if you look at this graph, what you'll notice is the very thing underneath is we're not talking about months or days. I mean, we have some dates in there, but we're talking about years. We're talking about time frames to dismantle this malware and this infrastructure that takes years. Taking down Avalanche was a multi-year effort, multi-jurisdictional, hundreds if not thousands of law enforcement officers and industry subject matter experts working to dismantle this. The new guys can bring up a new one in a couple of days. All right, it's pretty easy to get new malware and adapt malware. So it's interesting. There's some other stats here from Avalanche. It was 30 countries, 64 top-level domains, operated by 40 registry operators. We didn't have the number of MLATs here, but it was a lot. And this is still going on. In fact, if you've heard of Andromeda, what Andromeda is really a follow-up from Avalanche. It's some of the same malware variants plus some new ones. So, you know, if law enforcement take years, the attackers, Well, firstly, that they're not bound by regulation and rules and morals like the guys on the good side are. So their time frame is hours or days. They operate in internet speeds, right? So, you know, if a botnet operator can go needs to register a name, well, that takes him 5 minutes, right? Anybody here ever registered a domain name? It's, if it's available, it's pretty quick, right? Michaela, you could sell me a domain name in a few minutes. Yeah, it's not hard. Leasing that out, that doesn't take any time either because they have the platforms, they have pretty websites with drop-down things. Then they need to go and actually start infecting people. Well, that's normally like a phishing campaign or a drive-by malware drop or something like that. Well, be slow at this and say it's like 12 hours. And then maybe in a day, victims will start notifying security companies or law enforcement, assuming they notice. Right? And then weeks, months, sometimes years later, the final action of taking this stuff eventually takes place because of that law enforcement and operational security speed or timeline. Do you have a question?
My name is Lendon from Grenada. Question/curiosity. You mentioned a lot of the bad guys purchase legitimate domains for the wrong reason. So as a TLD, what mechanisms are there in place to track what percentage of your domains are used for legitimate versus illegitimate uses?
Okay, so that's an interesting question. And we're trying to do some statistics on this, but defining what is legitimate and illegitimate is not always straightforward. There are certain types of abuse that we are measuring, and what we're looking at is what we call reputation lists that are published and used by the security industry to protect networks and the names they put in there. They don't catch all the abuse, but we're using it as an indicator. But we're not the registry operator, okay? So we're doing this from a purely put data into the policy perspective. It's not as easy as it sounds. You've got to identify good, reputable, and I guess trustworthy is probably the word, list providers, and then you've got to gather various other forms of information, like associating, for example, a name with a registrar requires doing Whois queries because you're looking for the registrar ID. And then you've got to curate that data and manage that data and then look at what that means. Data gives you questions, not answers most of the time. So we have some percentages and we've published some data, and it's preliminary because we're still working on this system. But we know that a large portion of the abuse types, spam, botnet command and control, malware, and phishing, sit with a small number of registries. We have anecdotal data that suggests that pricing drives this abuse towards different registries, registrars, and that's kind of logical when you think about it. And I think Michaela pointed to this. If you're paying $500 a name, you can afford to do a lot of security work. If they're at $10 a name or $1 a name, they're more attractive to the bad guys, and you don't have the funds to do that kind of work. And Michaela, you can intercede if you wish.
Yeah, thanks. Michael Nail again for the record, or whatever. Just on that query, which is an interesting one, at the registry level, as John points out, there are various data feeds you can use. At the registrar level, I mean, ultimately, how do I frame this? It's not our job to be the internet police, but at the same time, a fraudulent A fraudulent registration is going to lead to a chargeback, and a chargeback costs me more than I would have made from the domain name, so I don't want the chargeback. Sorry, do you understand what the chargeback is? Credit card chargeback. So essentially, if I steal John's credit card and I go to Amazon and I buy a book or a CD or a phone or whatever, he will eventually realize that the order on his credit card is not valid, that I've stolen his credit card. He'll go to his bank. His bank will cancel the credit card, give him a new one, and then they will send a message to the merchant, the shop, or the registrar, or the hosting provider, and reverse the payment. When they reverse the payment, though, as the merchant, we get kind of fined, as it were. So if the order was for $10, it'll cost me maybe $50. If I have to challenge the chargeback, because that happens all the time, people decide to use chargebacks as a way of getting a refund, that will cost me money as well. So the kind of things that we would do, like my company does, is we do things like we will check to see if the IP address is a proxy, if the IP address is for a user network or is for a server. There is no valid reason why a web server should be on my order form, for example. There is no valid reason why particular networks should be anywhere near an order form. Also, you make business decisions. So, for example, I don't sell much to China, so therefore Chinese IP addresses have a bad reputation on our system. We're an Irish company, so Irish IP addresses have a good reputation, and so on and so forth. As a registry, it's a bit more complicated because, obviously, as John says, I mean, you're kind of dealing with other things, but there's certain patterns you can look at. The price one is something that is, you know, people can debate it, but if you look at the data, there's usually a correlation of some kind. There's a few ccTLDs that have given away lots of domains, and they had to take certain actions to deal with that. But, I mean, anybody wants to talk further about it, please. I'm sure John would be happy to take it offline.
Thanks for lining me up to take up more questions offline, Michaela. You're too kind. There are things you can measure and there are actions you can do, all of which have a cost. And there's a lot of discussion in the ICANN realm as well, especially with the Public Safety Working Group and the registrars and the registries, around what exactly is the role of industry to deal with this abuse. As ICANN organization, staff, we don't operate much infrastructure. We don't operate registries and registrars, etc. So we tend to look at it more from, can we measure this to give input and insight into the policy discussion? It's a problem. Everybody knows it's a problem. Nobody wants these registrations in their system. They cost them money and they hurt their reputation. So I think there is definitely a incentive for people in the industry to take action, and they balance that against all the normal business things of cost and whether or not this is their role. Taking action against a name also has risks associated with it, such as liability if you make mistakes, etc. So although it sounds like a very straightforward, well, this is bad, therefore we must do something conversation, in the real world, there's all kinds of other things you have to factor into it. And this is why the policy discussion around this is hard, and you should follow these discussions. I encourage that here at the ICANN meetings. And, once again on the timeline, the bad guys just get to act much faster than the good guys do. The good guys are bound by policy and process and regulation and morals that the bad guys don't have. For example, technically speaking, we could probably, somebody could probably send data to the infected machines, because we know where they are, to have them clean themselves up. Right? That sounds like a brilliant idea, doesn't it? Except for that's illegal in most places. You're actually touching somebody's machine without their permission. So although technically that might be an interesting idea, it's not something that the law enforcement and governments can just go and do. So there's a bit of a balance in favor of the bad guys, unfortunately. But I think that's the same in the real world, too. So staying on Avalanche, five people were arrested. One of them was just rearrested last week or the week before. There were 37 searches that took place in seven countries. This is law enforcement going into buildings and taking machines and people. 39 servers in 13 countries, and 221 servers were actually taken offline. So 64 TLDs, 830,000 domain names were blocked. Remember, not taken away from people, but actually prevented from being registered. And what law enforcement and industry are doing now is what they always end up doing, which is going out and telling people about it and trying to remediate, to try and actually fix the system. And they work with ISPs and certs, et cetera, to do that. And it's a lot harder to clean things up than it is to get them infected. And the sad thing is that often when you get machines cleaned, they get reinfected again later because it's just bad hygiene. That's just the way people are. People don't update their machines. So Mariah is the other well-known botnet out there. You know, and we call this a lesson that we didn't learn. So there's all this new hardware out there, and developers, etc., just aren't securing the systems the way they probably should do, and we've done this in the past. This isn't new. We come with a new technology. We need to get it to the market pretty fast. Security is never the highest priority. We know all these things, and unfortunately, I think this is just human nature and the nature of some of these technology businesses. So I don't predict this getting any better anytime soon. So as I said earlier, that's interesting. It does weird things with my slides. So Mirai was really one of these issues where we clearly saw it was IoT devices. Right? A lot of these botnets we know have touched on video servers and web cameras, and we've seen infections in medical devices, you know, all kinds of things. Anything with an operating system is, of course, vulnerable by default. But in Mirai, this was exploitation of well-known vulnerabilities. Like I said, I had one of these devices that I'd reported the vulnerability. Arguably, it's more of a lack of hygiene in the way they maintain things than an actual vulnerability months before. So this isn't anything that was unknown. You know, these things are listening on Telnet. Does everybody know what Telnet is? No, I can see people shaking their head. That's because you're not supposed to be using it anymore. We deprecated this. We got rid of this and told everybody it was a bad idea sometime in the 90s. It's basically what we tend to do when we connect to a machine is we do what we call a secure shell or SSH. It's a way of connected over an encrypted and authenticated channel to a machine to manage it. Telnet was the stuff before that where you just connected with, if you're lucky, a password, and there was no encryption. And so why is this the default on machines that are being released in this century? Because we got rid of it last century. This would be like deploying a brand new automobile design without a seatbelt. And you're about to tell me why you love Telnet.
Tamar Gavrichenko from Creator Labs. One thing here is the Telnet itself isn't a problem here, because it could as well be SSH, but hard-coded administrative credentials on a publicly available firmware is a problem itself. Yeah, so it could as well be on some IoT devices that there's a web interface which is HTTPS with all the certificate stuff, but it's still hard-coded credentials. And in case of initial cameras with Mirai, there were about at least about 20 passwords for like millions of devices. So yeah, this is a main issue. So basically, what's IoT is bringing us is the amount of technical debt, which is just built into the infrastructure, and yeah, basically nobody cares about how to resolve it.
Yeah, there were so many different problems with these devices. Telnet was one of them, and we just use that as, you know, this is ages, but what we see very, very frequently on devices is standard passwords that are published on lists. If you look at DNS changer, the one that I talked about earlier, the way it got into those routers, it just used the standard password that you can download from a list. If you can Google it. If you have a device at home, you can literally Google the passwords.
Another recent example, but I'm not going to abuse microphone for long, but another funny example of this is a built-in Apple OS X password generator, not the one in Safari, but the other, which can be used to generate a password for your App Store account, which actually, by default, generates passwords, which are too easy to brute force, given a nice vocabulary, like minutes or something. So, yeah, by the way, stay aware.
So the message is we're all doomed. Unless you're in the security field, in which case you're employed. Okay. So, as our friend here was saying, there are lots of issues with Mirai. Default credentials not being the least of them. And these devices have been used again and again, these types of devices. And when there are tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of these devices out there, it allows you to have pretty large botnets. And depending on the type of device, they may be actually designed for high throughput. Now, if you think of a video server, that's a machine that's actually designed to push a lot of bandwidth. Right? They have the capability to push video and sometimes multiple streams of video. So they're actually really good for DDoS because you can send lots and lots of traffic. And you have to remember that most people don't monitor their networks. So the end user that has installed this will have no idea this is happening. This was the WannaCry, just a timeline. The patch that would have prevented this was out months before the exploitation. If you got hit by WannaCry, did anybody get hit by WannaCry here? Am I going to upset somebody? You should have patched your machine 3 months before. Yeah, I know your customers probably did, Michaela. If you'd been patching your machines, if you'd been practicing good hygiene on your systems, it would never have attacked you. But people don't, right? People don't update their machines. They don't update their operating system. It's human nature. So, you know, in January, the vulnerability advisory was given out. Microsoft patched it in March. The big WannaCry attack wasn't until, the really big one wasn't really until May 12th, the one that hit all the news. It could have been avoided. And this is the thing about having the kill switch in there. We don't know why they did this. There's a lot of suspicion about whether or not they were doing it to prevent people putting this into sandboxes. I don't think we'll ever know unless the guy gets arrested and tells us. But it was interesting. So somebody figured it out. I don't know if they... I've not actually talked to the researcher who did this, so I don't know if he figured it out and registered the name, or he registered the name and just got lucky. But either way, we should be thankful, because it killed the exploitation of WannaCry pretty much overnight. So people got very lucky. I suspect that people have read this and won't make that mistake again.
So I was involved in the research.
Yeah, I know you were.
Ended up being with that being registered. The researcher who found it registered it because he noticed it wasn't registered. He hadn't finished reading the code until after the kill switch domain was registered and sent out. And then after the registration happened, the infection rate dropped dramatically, and we tried to figure out why, and it was because he found the kill switch. And the particular person that found that is... it's hard to talk to him right now because he's being investigated for another crime.
Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. We got lucky that he registered that name, and when he put it in the DNS, everything went away and it was better again. So let's talk about abuse in an ICANN context, being as we're all here for the wonderful ICANN meeting. That's where you all go, yay! So ICANN discussions regularly touch on abuse issues. You may not always realize that some of the issues they're talking about touch on abuse, but regularly they do. So a few things that are going on at the moment. Who is accuracy? Has anybody here heard of the term who is accuracy? It's been an ongoing discussion forever. As far back as I can remember, and I'm old, I've been here a long time. And it's all about access to who is registration data that is accurate and useful. Those discussions happen all over the place. That crosses with discussions about something called GDPR coming out of Europe. Has everybody heard of GDPR? Yep, this is basically, really, you shouldn't be publishing all this accurate, personally identifiable data about people. So those two things are nicely in conflict, which should give us lots of fun discussions. The issue of public safety. We use the term public safety because not everybody involved in dealing with badness is law enforcement, right? There's a lot of private security organizations, and there's also a lot of government organizations involved in trying to protect the public and the public safety that aren't necessarily law enforcement. And there's a lot of discussion going on at the moment about reporting abuse and measuring abuse. I've giving a presentation later in the week about our measurement systems, and I've already given a few this week. So there's a lot of stuff about abuse going on here. They might not necessarily call it abuse, but it does affect it. And once again, I was pushing the wrong button. So who is accuracy, GDPR, public safety, and reporting abuse are very common topics. Often these discussions are quite heated. They are fun to watch. They're not necessarily fun to be part of all the time, but they are interesting to watch. There are many different competing interests here, all of which are valid, but they just happen to compete. And then finding what the similarities and the common ground is always an interesting thing to watch. We say public safety. Now, the Government Advisory Committee... You can go ahead.
Thank you. Tosca Bruno van Vijveke on the board of publicinterestregistry.org. As a relative newcomer, tell me a little bit more about these all valid but competing interests that cause heated debate. That's really interesting to me.
So... You have one side that looks at abuse and just says, well, it should just be gone. And then you have the other side, for example, Michele just got them and said, well, there's cost to that. right? And then you have people that say that names should be cheap. And you have people say that names should be secure. Right? These are competing values. They might not sound like they're competing, but they are. You know, you cannot say the wall has to be black and the wall has to be white. It has to be, it can be one or the other. So it's a lot of those kind of things. Pretty much everybody has a lot of the same interests in the end, in that, you know, everybody wants a secure network. Nobody wants this rubbish in their systems. But the way you do it and what the policy will be will affect businesses and they will affect safety. So there's always a contention between how far you go one way or the other. So it makes for very interesting discussions.
Understood. Thank you.
So as I was saying, go ahead, Michaela.
Just for the lady who was up at the mic, if you're interested, come along to the RDS PDP working group sessions. You will find a room full of very passionate and very engaged people who cannot agree on anything apart from the fact that they may or may not like coffee and alcohol. Anything to do with the subject matter under discussion is probably not going to be agreed on. But there's a lot of different interests, and it's an ongoing debacle discussion. There's also a session on Monday afternoon, I think, on GDPR, which is a cross-community session. I think it's Monday, which is where you'll also hear from different interests. You'll have intellectual property versus public safety versus privacy versus those of us who actually try to make a living.
Passionate, that's a good word. I like that. Lots of passionate discussion. So the Government Advisory Committee has something called the Public Safety Working Group. Abuse is a public safety issue. So the Government Advisory Committee gives a lot of... The way they communicate with the rest of the ICANN community is through communiques. So they've had various communiques over the years that have talked about abuse. Some of it defining what they thought abuse was, some of it talking about what new protections we should have it when we had the new GTLD rounds. So obviously, governments worry about their public, so they worry about public safety, so it's a logical place for a lot of input to come from into the policy discussion. They have this working group, and like I said, it's public safety working group, and public safety encompasses both law enforcement, but also subject matter experts. So they have the ability to invite non-governmental people, even though it's a government advisory committee working group. So they deliberately set it up so they could bring in subject matter experts, which is very good. And look, here's the same list of issues that they're dealing with, GDPR, who is accuracy, carrier grade NAT, network address translators is a fun thing that they worry about. This is a different type of identifier issue. It's not a DNS issue. It's an IP addressing and associating IP addresses with interfaces or users' interfaces that law enforcement worry about how they find information about identifiers. It's different to DNS, but it's another identifier issue. The issue of FastFlux, as I said, they're not happy that people can do this, and they have the discussions about, well, is there anything we can do in the case that there are actually legitimate uses for this? And, of course, DNS abuse in all its forms is something that they're very interested in. And they have open groups. We, of course, have contracts. ICANN is not a regulator in the sense that, you know, we're not some kind of regulatory authority that has dictates and regulations that people have to follow. We manage our relationships through contracts. We have policy discussions in the ICANN realm, and the outcome of those policy normally gets formulated in the contracts. We have contracts with generic top-level domains. We do not have contracts with country code top-level domains. So these contracts are really just for the registries for GTLDs. They have some specifications. We're going to share these slides. I'm not going to read through them all. I'm not a lawyer, I probably don't even understand half of them, but we have the registry base agreement, so that's with the TLD operators, and then we have the registrar accreditation agreement with the registrars. And both of those have elements related to abuse and the handling of abuse. So let's talk about what we're doing this week. There are a few sessions that I think might be interesting to you. I believe that tomorrow is Sunday. The government advisory group will be giving an update, so you can hear what they're doing. They've given an update, I assume, to the GAC. It's on the schedule as being open. The links are in here. On Tuesday, they will have another meeting, actually two meetings as a board. They will have their own meeting where they discuss their topics. That's the first one. And then they're going to have quite a long session. I believe it's most of the morning dedicated to GDPR and who is, or whatever is going to replace who is registry data. So if you're interested, go to that one. I think that's going to be really interesting. And then on Wednesday, there is a group, can't remember what DNA stands for, Domain Name Association? The Domain Name Association Healthy Domain Initiative, which is actually an industry initiative to deal with these issues. So not a ICANN policy thing, but actually industry getting together and saying, how are we affected by this?
Was I there?
Yeah. I've hit the wrong buttons again, didn't I? So there's actually an industry initiative, and they're going to talk about what they're doing in this realm. And their work's really interesting. So if you're interested in abuse and how people in the industry are actually taking action on their own, go to this one. And then it doesn't work again. All right. So I have 1 minute less, and I'm happy to take questions. Can you use the microphone, please?
Toma Grichenko again. Now, my newcomer and fellow head-on. So, our fellowship program leader, Siranush, has just told us there's no stupid questions from a newcomer, so challenge accepted. So, on the agenda of the meeting, there are two or three meetings related to Security and Stability Advisory Committee. So, basically, it sounds like this is something which is related to security and stability. So, could you please explain in a few words what's going on there on this advisory committee? Thank you.
Okay, so ICANN has two sorts of input bodies, if you want. There's the supporting organizations, the GNSO, CNSO, etc., and then there are advisory committees. So, this Security and Stability Advisory Committee can advise on any matters relating to security. So they do have an interest in abuse, and they are working on documents related to abuse. They also have interest in who is and who is data. Some of the meetings are closed sessions, and some of them are open. I'm not sure which are which, but it is on the schedule. And I would encourage you, I mean, because especially you seem to be working in the security field, I would absolutely encourage you to go to those meetings and introduce yourself, or if you don't want to, I'll introduce you to some of the members, and have discussions with them about what they're working on, because they do fascinating work. It's quite a interesting group of individuals with a lot of skills in this across the security realm. So they are touching on abuse issues, but they're touching on many other things, DNSSEC, protocol changes, the whole gamut of security issues that affect the identifier systems.
Get it, thank you.
Fazi.
Hello, John. Farzan Baidi speaking. I had the impression, and thank you, this was really great. I specifically attended this session to see how you define DNS abuse because we want to keep it technical. so that we don't come up with like copyright and say infringing copyright is DNS abuse and then put it in there. So thank you very much. But I was wondering if you consider, or if the public safety group considers the technical definition of DNS abuse, what I assume that SSAC has actually is defining and working on the definition of abuse, or they have already something. So if they take that on, how do they ensure that you are not, ICANN does not go beyond the technical definition? Also, your presentation was very grim. Come on, it's not the end of the world. IoTs actually can be useful.
Well, they can if you want to make a cup of coffee from the distance, yes. I actually have hundreds, literally hundreds of IoT devices in my home network, and I use them all the time. So and some of them are fantastically secure, but some of them are not. The issue of the definition of DNS abuse, specifically in my job, being the guy at ICANN that has to look at this kind of stuff, is, I don't know if problematic is the word, but it's interesting that we don't have very clear definitions, or probably even worse, that we have multiple clear definitions. And SSAC would be a very good place, and I know they are working on abuse issues, that would be a very good place to help us, as would the PSWG, with terminology about what we do consider to be identifier abuse. And I use identifier abuse in this rather than DNS in this case, because there are other abuse types. And if they could give me a nice crisp list and say this is identifier abuse and in remit, and this is not and is out of remit, I would be so extremely happy. I don't foresee that happening anytime soon, because as you indicated, there are people that think certain elements are DNS abuse, and others that would say, well, that's content, or that's legality, or, you know, sometimes it's freedom of speech issues, etc. There's a lot of things that get conflated. Like, as I said, there are many opinions of this, and I think Michele called it passionate discussion. Okay, I ran out of time, which is probably good. I will be around for a little while, so if you have questions you didn't want to ask into the microphone, feel free to approach me. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you very much, everybody. And if you want to hang around, in about 10 minutes, we will have our next How It Works on Internet Networking, and we will be talking about IPv4, IPv6 protocols, internet addressing, and how routing of data on the internet is done. Thank you.